Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. Her name is Soraya Dorabi. She is a venture capital and impact investor who has an absolutely fascinating background, working for first with the New York Times social media group, then with a startup that eventually gets purchased by Open Table, and then becoming a venture investor that focuses on women and people of color-led startups, which is not merely a way to quote-unquote do good, but it's a broad area that is wildly underserved by the venture community and therefore is very inefficient, meaning there's a lot of upside in this. You can both do well and do good by investing in these areas. I found this to be absolutely fascinating, and I think you will also. If you're at all interested in entrepreneurship, social media, startups, deal flow, how funds identify who they want to invest in, what it's like to actually experience an exit as an entrepreneur, I think you'll find this to be quite fascinating. So with no further ado, my conversation with TMV's Soraya Dorabi.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My special guest this week is Soraya Dorabi. She is the co-founder and general partner of TMV, a venture capital firm that has had a number of exits despite being relatively young. 65% of TMV's startups are led by women or people of color. Previously, she was the co-founder of FoodSpotting, an app named App of the Year by Apple and Wired that was eventually purchased by Open Table. Soraya Dorabi, welcome to Bloomberg.
Oh my goodness, Barry, thank you for having me.
I've been looking forward to this conversation since our previous discussion. We were on a Zoom call with a number of people discussing blockchain and crypto, and it was really quite fascinating. And I thought you had such an unusual and interesting background. I thought you would make a perfect guest for the show. Let's start with, you were manager of digital partnerships and social media at the New York Times when social media was really just ramping up. Tell us about what that was like. Tell us what you did in the late aughts at the Times.
Oh, absolutely. I was fresh-faced out of university. I had recently graduated with mostly a journalism concentration from Georgetown and did a small stint at Condé Nast right around the time they acquired Reddit for what will soon be nothing, because Reddit's expecting to IPO at around $15 billion. And that experience at Reddit really offered me a decent understanding of convergence, you know, what was happening to digital media properties as they partnered for the first time with nascent but scaling social media platforms. And so the New York Times generously offered me a role that was originally called Manager of Buzz Marketing. I think that's what they called social media in 2006. And then that eventually evolved into Manager of Digital Partnerships and Social Media, which in essence meant that we were aiming to be the first media property in the world to partner with companies that are household names today, but back in the day were fairly unknown. The Facebooks and the Twitters, of course, but also platforms that really took off for a while and then plateaued potentially, you know, the Tumblrs of the world. And it was my responsibility to understand how we could effectively generate an understanding of, you know, the burgeoning demographics of these platforms, how we could potentially bring income into the Times for working with them, but more importantly, how the journalists could authentically represent themselves on new mediums. And so that was a really wonderful role to have directly out of university and then, you know, introduced me to folks with whom I still work today.
That's quite interesting. So when you're looking at a lot of these companies, you mentioned Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr. How do you know if something's going to be a Facebook or a MySpace, a Twitter or a Tumblr? What's going to survive or not? When you're cutting deals with these companies on behalf of the Times, are you thinking in terms of, hey, who's going to stick around? Wasn't that much earlier that the dot-com implosion took place prior to you starting with the Times?
It's true, although I don't remember the dot-com implosion, so maybe that naivete helped because all I had was enthusiasm, unbridled enthusiasm for these new companies. And I operated then and now still with a beta approach to business, you know, testing out new platforms and trying to track the data. What's scaling? At what velocity is this platform scaling? And can we hitch a ride on a rocket ship if they will still allow? But a lot of our partnerships then and now as an investor are predicated upon relationships. And so, you know, as most, I think, terrific investors that I listen to, who I listen to on your show at least, will talk to you about the importance of believing in the founder and the founder's vision. And that was the case back then, remains the case today.
So when you were at the Times, your tenure there very much overlapped the great financial crisis. You're looking at social media. How did that manifest the world of social media when it looked like the world of finance was imploding at that time?
Well, it was a very interesting time. I remember having quite literally 30-second meetings with Sorkin as he would run upstairs to my floor on the 8th floor to talk about a DealBook app that we wanted to launch, and then he'd run back down to his desk to do much more important work, I think, in revealing the financial crisis to the world. So 30-second meetings aside, you know, it was considered to be, in some ways, a great awakening for the Web 2.0 era. As the economy was bottoming out, like any recession, it also offered a really interesting opportunity for entrepreneurs, many of whom had just been laid off or were looking at this as a sizable moment to begin to work on a side hustle or a life pursuit. And so there's, you know, it's unsettling, of course, any recession or any great awakening, but, you know, lemonade, window opening, door closing. There was a true opportunity as well for social media founders, founders focusing on convergence in any industry, really, many of which were predicated in New York, to begin, you know, tinkering on an idea that could ultimately become quite powerful. Because if you're at the earliest stage of the riskiest asset class being venture, there's always going to be seed funding for a great founder with a great idea. And so I think some of the smartest people I've ever met in my life, I met at the onset of the aftermath of that particular era in time.
So you mentioned side hustle. Let's talk a little bit about food spotting, which is described as a visual geo-local guide to dishes instead of restaurants, which yes, sounds appealing to me. and it was named App of the Year by both Apple and Wired. How do you go from working at a giant organization like the Times to a startup with you and a co-founder and a handful of other coders working with you?
Well, 5 to 6 nights a week after my day job at the New York Times, I would go to networking events with technologists and entrepreneurs after hours. I saw that as a priority, to be able to partner from the earliest infancy with interesting companies for that media entity. I needed to at least know who these founders were in New York and Silicon Valley. And so without a true agenda other than, you know, keen curiosity to learn what these businesses were all about, I would go to the New York Tech Meetup, which Scott Heiferman of Meetup.com, who's now a cherished LP in my fund, would create. And back then, the New York Tech Meetup was fewer than 40 people. I believe it's in the tens of thousands now. In New York City alone. And so it was there that I met some really brilliant people, and in particular, a gentleman my age who was building a cloud computing company that you know, was essentially arbitraging AWS to repopulate consumer-facing cloud data services for enterprises, B2B2C play. And we all thought it would be Dropbox. The company ultimately wasn't, but I will tell you the people with whom I worked at that startup, because I left the New York Times to join that startup, to this day remain some of the most successful people in Silicon Valley and Alley. And actually one of those persons is a partner at our firm now, Darshan. He was the co-founder of that particular company, which was called Drop.io. So I stayed there very quickly. I was there for about 6 months. But at that startup, I observed how a young person my age could build a business, raise VC. He was the son of a VC, and so he was exceptionally attuned to the changing landscape of venture and, you know, how to position the company so that it would be attractive to the RREs of the world and the BFJs. And
define those for us, RREs and BFJs.
Pardon. Still today, very relevant and very successful venture capital firms. And in particular, they were backing a lot of the most interesting ideas in the Web 2.0 era when I joined this particular startup in 2010. Well, that startup was acquired by Facebook, and I often say, no thanks to me. But the mafia that left that particular startup continues to this day to co-invest with one another and help one another's ideas succeed. And it was there that I began to build the confidence, I think, that I really needed to explore my own entrepreneurial ideas or to help accelerate ideas. And Food Spotting was a company that I was advising while at that particular startup that was really taking off. This was in the early days of when Instagram was still in beta, and we observed that the most commonly posted photos on Instagram were of food. And so by following that lead, we basically built an app around an activity that continues to take place every single day. I still see food photos on Twitter every time I open up my stream. And decided to match that with an algorithm that showed folks wherever they were in the world. I'm in Greece, I might want spanakopita, or if I'm in Japan, Okinawa. We helped people discover not just the Michelin-rated restaurants or the most popular local haunt in New York City, but rather what's the dish that they should be ordering. And then what the app was extremely good at was populating beautiful photos of that particular dish and then mirroring them with accredited reviews from the Zagats of the world, but also popular celebrity chefs like Marcus Samuelson in New York. And that's why we took off, because it was a cult-beloved app of its time, back when there were only 3 geolocation apps in the iTunes App Store. It was we and Twitter and Foursquare. So there was a first-mover advantage. Looking back in hindsight, I think we sold that company too soon. OpenTable bought the business 1.5 years later. Priceline bought OpenTable. Both were, you know, generous liquidity events for the founders that enabled us to become angel investors. But sometimes I wish that app still existed today, because I could see it being still incredibly handy in my day-to-day life.
To say the least. So did you have to raise money for Food Spotting, or did you just bootstrap it? And how did that experience compare with what that exit was like?
We did. We raised from tremendous investors like Ivan Senkit of Felicia's Ventures, whom I think of as being one of the best angel investors of the world. He was on the board. But we didn't raise that much capital before the business was ultimately sold. And what I learned in some of those early conversations, I would say, that may have ultimately led to LOIs and term sheets, was that so much of M&A is about whining and dining. And as a young person, particularly for me, you and I discussed before the show, Barry, we're both from New York. I'm not from a business-oriented family, to say the least. My mom's an academic. My father was a cab driver in New York City. And so there are certain elements of this game, you know, raising venture and ultimately trying to exit your company, that you don't learn from a business book. And I think navigating that as a young person was complicated. If I had to speak economically.
Quite fascinating. What is purposeful change?
Well, the word purpose, I suppose, especially in the VC game, could come across as somewhat of a cliche. But we try to be as specific as possible when we allude to the impact that our investments can potentially make. And so specifically, we invest in 5 verticals at our early stage New York City-based venture fund. We invest in what we call the care economy, which is companies making all forms of care, from elder care to pet care to health care, more accessible and equitable. We invest in financial inclusion. So this is a spin on fintech, These are companies enabling wealth creation, education, and most importantly, literacy for all, something I think is really important, the democratization of finance. We invest in the future of work, which are companies creating better outcomes for workers and employees alike. We invest in the future of work, which are companies creating better outcomes for workers and employers alike. We invest in purpose as it pertains to transportation. So not immediately intuitive, but companies creating transparency and efficiency around global supply chain and mobility. I can talk about why we picked that category in a bit. And sustainability, so tech-enabled sustainable solutions. These are companies optimizing for sustainability from process to product. With these five verticals combined, we have a sub-thesis, which is that diverse founders and diverse employee bases and diverse cap tables is not charity, it's simply good for business. And so in addition to being hyper-specific about the impact in which we invest, we also make it a priority and a mandate at our firm to invest in the way the world truly looks. And when we say that on our website, we link to census data. And so we invest in men and women equally. We invest in diverse founders almost all of the time. And we track this with data and precision to make sure that our investments reflect not just one zip code in California, but rather America at large.
And you have described this as non-obvious founders. Tell us a little bit about that phrase.
Well, non-obvious is a term you hear a lot when you go out to Silicon Valley. And I don't know, I think it was coined by a well-known early PayPal employee turned billionaire turned investor who actually has a conference centered around non-obvious ideas. And I love the phrase. I love thinking about, you know, investment theses that are contrary, because when you have a contrarian point of view, you often have outlier results, because if you're right, you're taking the risk and you're capturing the reward. When you're investing in non-obvious founders, it should be that exact same outcome. And so it always sort of befuddled me as a person with a hard-to-pronounce name in Silicon Valley why it was that we're an industry that prides itself on investing in innovation and groundbreaking ideas and the next frontier of X, Y, and Z. And yet, all of those founders in which we were investing collectively tended to kind of look the same. They were coming from the same schools and the same types of families. And so, to me, there was nothing innovative at all about backing that Wharton, GSB, HBS guy who was second or third generation finance. And what really excites me about venture is, you know, capturing a moment in time that's young, but also the energy is palpable around not only the idea in which the founder is building, but the categories in which they're tackling. And if that sounds vague, I'll be a little bit more specific. And so at TMV, we try to see things before they're even coming around the bend. For instance, we were early investors in a company called City Block Health, which is offering best-in-class health care specifically for low-income Americans. So they focus on the most vulnerable populations, which are underserved with health care, and they're offering them best-in-class health care access at affordable pricing because it's predominantly covered through payer relationships. And this company is so powerful to us for three reasons. Because it's not simply offering healthcare to the elite. It's democratizing access to care, which I think is absolutely necessary and paramount for success of any kind. We thought this was profoundly interesting because the population which they serve is also incredibly diverse. And so when you look at that investment over, say, a comparable company, I won't name names, that offers for-profit healthcare out of pocket, you can see why this is an opportunity that excites us as impact investors. But we don't see the diversity of the team as impact. We actually see that as their unfair advantage because they are accessing a population authentically that others might ignore.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Let me see if I understand this correctly. When you talk about non-obvious founders and spaces like this, what I'm hearing from you is you're looking at areas where the market has been very inefficient with how it allocates capital, that these areas are just overlooked and ignored. Hey, if you want to go into Silicon Valley and compete with everybody else and pay up for what looks like the same old startup, maybe it'll be successful, maybe it won't. That's hyper-competitive and hyper-efficient. These are areas that are just overlooked, and this is more than just do-goodery, for lack of a better word. There are genuine economic opportunities here with lots of potential upside.
Absolutely. So my business partner and I, you know, she and I found each other 20 years ago as undergrads at Georgetown, but we went into business after she was successful in being one of the only women in the world to take a shipping business public with her family. Mm-hmm. And we got together and we said, we have really unique access, she and I. And the first SPV that we collaborated on back in 2016 was for a young business at the time, started by two women, that was focused on medical apparel predominantly for nurses. Now it's nurses and doctors. And they were offering a solution to make medical apparel, so scrubs, more comfortable and more fashionable for nurses. I happen to have nurses and doctors in my family, so doing due diligence for this business was relatively simple. I called my aunt, who's a nurse practitioner and nurse for life, and she said, oh, absolutely. When you're, you know, working in a uniform at the hospital, you want something comfortable with extra pockets that makes you look and feel good. The VCs that they spoke to at the time, and they've been very public about this, in the beginning anyway, were less excited because they correlated this particular business with a fashion company. Mm-hmm. But if you look back at our original memo, which I saved, it says FIGS, now public on the New York Stock Exchange, is a utility business. It's a uniform company that can verticalize beyond just medical apparel. And so we helped value that company at $15 million back in 2016. And this year, in 2021, they went public at a $7 billion market cap.
Wow.
And so what is particularly exciting for us, going back to that conversation around non-obvious founders, is that particular business, FIGS, was the first company in history to have two female co-founders go public. And when we think of success at TMV, we don't just think about financial success and IRR and, you know, cash-on-cash return for our LPs. Of course, we think about that. But we also think, who are we cheerleading and with whom do we want to go into business? And what's the story on the other side of the fence that we want to tell? And, you know, we measure non-obvious not just based on gender or race, because I think that's a little too precise in some ways. Sometimes for us, non-obvious is around geography. I'm calling you from Athens, as you know, and in Greece yesterday I got together with a fund manager. I'm lucky enough to be an LP in her fund. And she was talking about the average size of a seed round in Silicon Valley these days, hovering around $30 million. And I was scratching my head because at our fund, TMV, we just don't see that. You know, we're investing in Baltimore, Maryland, and in Austin, Texas, and the average price for us to invest in a seed round is closer to $5 or $6 million. And so we actually can capture larger ownership of the pie early on, and then develop a very close-knit relationship with these founders that might not be as networked in the Valley, where there's 30 VC funds to every one that exists in Austin, Texas.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think you're right to say that it's about inefficiencies in market, but also just about you know, being persistent and looking where others are not.
That's quite intriguing. Your team is female-led. You have a portfolio of companies that's about 65% women and people of color. Tell us how you go about finding these non-obvious startups.
That's a good question. You know, TMV celebrates its 5-year anniversary this year. So the way we go about finding companies now is a bit different than the way we began 5 years ago. Now it's systematic. We collectively as a partnership, there are many of us, take over 50 calls a month with tier one venture capital firms that have known us for a while, like the work that we do, believe in our value add, because the partnership comprised of former operators. And so we really roll up our sleeves to help. And when you've invested with these firms enough times, they will write to you and say, I found a company that's a little too early for us for XYZ reason, but it resonates and, you know, I think it might be for you. So we found some of our best deals that way. But other times we found our deal flow through building our own communities. And so when I first started as an emerging manager of a VC firm, mm-hmm. and roughly 30% of LP capital goes to EMs each year, but that's sort of an outsized percentage because when you think about, you know, the Lee Fixels of Addition Capital taking $1.3 billion of that pie, then you recognize the definition of an emerging manager might need to change a bit. Mm-hmm. So when I was starting as an EM, I recognized that the landscape wasn't necessarily leveled. If you weren't what's called a spin-out, somebody that has spent a few years at a traditional established blue-chip firm, then it's harder to, you know, develop and cultivate relationships with institutional LPs who will give you a shot, even though the data absolutely points to there being a real opportunity at capturing lightning in a bottle if you find the right EM with the right idea in the right market conditions, which is certainly what we're in right now. Hmm. And so I decided to start a network specifically tailored around helping women fund managers connect to one another. And it began as a WhatsApp group and a weekly Google Meet and has now blown into something that requires a lot of dedicated time. And so we're hiring an executive director for this group. It's called Transact Global. 250 Women X fund managers globally, from Hong Kong to Luxembourg to Venezuela, Canada, Nigeria, you name it, there are women fund managers in our group, and we have one of the most active deal flow channels in the world. And so two of our TMV deals over the last year, a fintech company combating student debt and helping young Americans save for retirement at the same time, as an example, came from this WhatsApp deal flow channel. So I think, you know, creating the community, being the change, so to speak, has been incredibly effective for us as a proprietary deal flow mechanism. And then last but not least, I think that, you know, having some sort of media presence really has helped. And so, you know, I posted a podcast and I've worked on building up what I think to be a fairly organic Twitter following over the years. And, you know, we surprise ourselves by getting some really exceptional founders cold pitching us on LinkedIn and on Twitter because we make ourselves available as next-gen EMs. So that's a sort of long-winded answer to your question, but it's not the traditional means by any means.
To say the least, are you the companies you're investing in, are they, and I'll try and keep this simple for people who are not all that well-versed in the world of venture, is it seed stage? Is it the A round, the B round? How far into their growth process do you put money in?
So it is a predominantly seed fund. We call our investments core investments. So these are checks that average between $1 and $1.5 million. Mm-hmm. So for about $1.25 million, on average, we're capturing 10 to 15% of a cap table. And in this era, that's called a seed round. It would probably be called a Series A 10 years ago.
Right.
And then we follow on through the Series A and at maximum take our pro rata at the B. So our goal by a Series B is to have on average 10% of a cap. And then we give ourselves a little bit of wiggle room with our modeling. We take Mars and Moonshot investments with smaller checks. So we call these initial interest checks. And initial interest means I'm interested, but your idea is so audacious, it won't prove itself out for 3 or 4 years. Or, to be very honest, we weren't the first to get into this cap, or, you know, you're picking a sequoia over us and we understand, but let's see if we can just promise you a bit of value add to edge our way into your business. And
right.
Oftentimes when you speak as a former founder yourself with a high level of compassion and you promise with integrity that you're going to work very hard for that company, they will increase the size of their round and they will carve out space for you. And so we do those types of investments rarely, 10 times in any given portfolio. But what's interesting in looking back at some of our outliers from Fund One, it came from those initial interest checks. So that's our model in a nutshell. We're pretty transparent about it. What we like about this model is that it doesn't make us tigers. We're off the board by the B, but we're still owning enough of the cap table to be a meaningful presence in the founders' lives and in their business. And it allows us to feel like we're not spraying and praying.
Spraying and praying is an amusing term. But I'm kind of intrigued by the fact that we used to call it smart money, but you're really describing it as value-added capital. When a founder takes money from TMV, they're getting more than just a check. They're getting the involvement from entrepreneurs who have been through the process from startup to capital raise to exit. Tell us a little bit about how that works its way into the deals you end up doing, who you look at, and what the sort of deal flow you see is like.
Well, years ago, I had the pleasure of meeting a world-class advertiser, and I was at his incredibly fancy office down on Wall Street, his ad agency, and he described to me with pride how he basically bartered his marketing services for 1% of a unicorn. And he was sort of showing off a bit about how for very little time and effort, a few months, he walked away with a relatively large portion of a business. And I thought, yes, that's clever, but for the founder, they gave up too much of their business too soon.
Right.
And I came up with an idea that I floated by Marina back in the day, where our original deck for TMV Fund One began with the slide, marketing is the future of venture and venture is the future of marketing. Meaning, if a VC fund were to position itself more like an ad agency, but rather than charging for its services, its go-to-market services, you offered them free of charge, but then you were paid in equity, then you could quantify the value that you were offering to these businesses. And back then, people laughed at us, even though all around New York City, ad agencies were really doing incredible work and benefiting from the startups in that ecosystem. And so we sort of changed the positioning a bit. And now we say to our LPs and to our founders, you're both clients of our firm. So we do think of ourselves as an agency. But on one side of our marketplace, you have LPs. And what they want is crystal clear. The value that they derive from us is through community and connectivity and co-investment. And that's it. It's pretty cut and dry. Call me up once a year when you have an exceptional opportunity. Let me invest alongside you. Invite me to dinners four times a year. Give me some information and a point of view that I can't get elsewhere. Thank you for your time. And I love that. It's a great relationship to have with incredibly smart people. It's cut and dry, but it's so different. What founders want is something more like a family. They want a VC on their board, you know, that they can turn to during critical moments. 2 a.m. on a Saturday is not an uncommon time for me to get a text message from a founder saying, what do I do? And so what they want is more like 24/7 services for a period of time. And they want to know when that relationship should start and finish. So it's sort of the Montessori approach to venture. We're going to tell them what we're going to tell them, tell them what they're telling them, tell them what they told them. We say to founders with a reverse pitch deck, so we pitch them as they're pitching us, here's what we promise to deliver for you for the first 18 to 24 months of your infancy, and then we promise you we'll mostly get lost. You can come back to us when your business is growing. If you want to do a tender and we'll operate an SPV through you, or if you simply want advice, we're never going to ignore you. But our specialty, our black belt, if you will, Barry, is in those first 24 months of your business that go to market. And so we've staffed up TMV to include, well, it's punching above our weight, but the co-founder of an exceptionally successful consumer marketing business, a growth marketer, a recruiter who helped one of our portfolio companies hire 40 of their earliest employees. We have a PR woman. You've met Leah. She's exceptional, whom I don't know how we would function sometimes because she's constantly writing and re-editing press releases for the founders with which we work. And then Anna, our copywriter, who came from IAC, and Sean, our creative director, used to be the design director for Rolling Stone, and I could go on and on. So some firms call this a platform team, but we call it the go-to-market team. And then we promise a set number of hours for every company that we invest into.
As
a result, go ahead.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business.
You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
No, that's just I'm completely fascinated by that. But I have to ask, maybe this is an obvious question or maybe it's not. So you sound very much like a non-traditional venture capital firm.
Yeah.
Who are your limited partners? Who are your clients? And what motivates them to be involved with TMV? Because it sounds so different than what has been a pretty standard model in the world of venture. One that's been, you know, tremendously successful for the top tier firms.
Our LP set is crafted with intention. And so 50% of our investors are institutional. This includes institutional sized family offices, the family offices in the multi-billions. We work with three major banks, Fortune 500 banks. We work with a couple of corporate Fortune 500s as investors or LPs. And a couple of fund-of-funds. So that's really run-of-the-mill. But 50% of our investors, and that's why I'm in Athens today, are family offices, global family offices, that I think are reinventing what venture is going to look like in the future. Because wealth has never been greater globally. There's $1 trillion of assets that are passing through the hands of one generation to the next. And what's super interesting to me as a woman is that historically, a lot of that asset transfer was from father to son, but actually for the first time in history, over 50%, so 51% of those asset inheritors are actually women. And so as my business partner could tell you, because she herself is a next gen, in prior generations, women were encouraged to go into the philanthropic or nonprofit side of the family business, right. And the sons were expected to take over the business or the family office, and all of that has just completely turned around in the last 10 years. And so my anchor investor is actually a young woman. She's under the age of 35. There's a little bit of our firm that's indie rock because we're not playing by the same rules that the establishment has played by. But certainly we're posturing ourselves to be able to grow into a blue chip firm, which is why we want to maintain that balance of 50% institutional and 50%, I would call it bespoke capital. And for the LPs that are bespoke, we work with an Australian family office and a Venezuelan family office and a Chilean family office and a Mexican family office and so on. For those family offices, we come to them, we invite them to events in New York City, we give them personalized introductions to our founders, and we get on the phone with them whenever they'd like. We host Zooms, we call them the Future of Everything series, so they can learn from us, and we get to know them as human beings. And I think that there's a reason why two-thirds of our Fund 1 LPs converted over into Fund 2, because they like that level of access. It's what the modern LP is really looking for.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the areas that you find intriguing. What sectors are really capturing your attention these days? What are you most excited about?
Well, Barry, I'm most excited about five categories for which we've been investing for quite some time, but they're really being accelerated due to the 2020 pandemic and a looming recession. And so we're particularly fascinated by not just healthcare investing, as it's been called in the past, but rather the care economy. I'm not a huge fan of the term femtech. It always sounds like fembot to me. But care as it pertains to women alone is a multi-trillion-dollar opportunity. And so when we think of the care economy, we think of healthcare, pet care, elder care, community care, personal care. As it pertains to young people, old people, men, women, children, we bifurcate and we look for interesting opportunities that don't exist because they've been undercapitalized and undervalued for so long. Case in point, we were early investors in Kind Body, a reproductive health care company focused on women who want to preserve their fertility because if you look at 2010 census data, you can see that the data has been there for some time that women in particular were delaying marriage and childbirth. And there are a lot of world-famous economists who will tell you this, you know, the global population will decline because we're aging and we're not necessarily having as many children as we would have in the past. plus it's expensive. And so we saw that as investors as a really interesting opportunity, and jumped on the chance to back Gina Bartosi, who's incredible, when she came to us with a way to make fertility preservation less expensive. So she followed the D2C playbook, and she started with a mobile clinic that helped women freeze their eggs, ostensibly. Mm-hmm. That company has gone on to raise hundreds, and that company is now valued in the hundreds of millions. And for us, you know, it was as simple as following our intuition as women fund managers. You know, we know what our peers are thinking about because we talk to them all the time. And I think the fact that, you know, we're bringing a new perspective to venture means that we're also bringing a new perspective to what has previously been called femtech. We invest in financial inclusion. Everyone in the world is investing in fintech. The self-directed financial mobile apps are always going to be capitalized, especially in a post-Robin Hood era. But we're specifically interested in the democratization of access to financial information. And we're specifically interested in student debt and alleviating student debt in America, because not only is it going to be one of the greatest challenges our generation will have to overcome, but it's also, you know, prohibiting us from living out the American dream, $1.7 trillion of student debt in America that needs to be alleviated. And then we're interested in the future of work, and long have been. This certainly was very much accelerated during the pandemic, but we've been investing in the 1099 economy and remote work for quite some time. And so really proud to have been the first check into a company called Bravely, which is an HR chatbot that helps employees inside of a company chat anonymously with HR reps outside of that company, so that's 1099, about issues like DEI and inclusion and upward mobility and culture setting and what to do when you're all of a sudden working from home. So that's an example of a future of work business. And then in the tech-enabled sustainable solutions category, it's a mouthful, so let's call that sustainability, we are proud to have been early investors in a company called Ridwell, out of Seattle, Washington, focused on not just privatized recycling, but upcycling and reconnaissance. Where are things going when we recycle them? You know, for me, always been a pretty big question. And so Ridwell allows you to re- and upcycle things that are hard to get rid of out of your home, like children's eyeglasses and paint and battery and, you know, single-use plastic. And it shows you where those things are going, which I think is super cool. And there's good reason why it has one of the highest NPS scores, net promoter scores, of any company I've ever worked with. People are craving this kind of modern solution. And last but not least, we invest in transportation, in part because of the unfair advantage my partner Marina brings to TMV. You know, she comes from a maritime family, and so we can pilot transportation technology within her own ecosystem. That's pretty great. But also because we're just fascinated by the fact that 90% of the world's commodities move on ships. And the biggest contributor to emissions in the world outside of, you know, corporates is coming from transportation. And so if we can sort of figure out this industry, we can solve a lot of the problems that our generation are inheriting. Now, these categories might sound massive, and we do consider ourselves a generalist firm, but we stick to five core sectors that we truly believe in, and we give ourselves room to kick out a sector or to add a new one with any given new fund. For the most part, we haven't needed to, because these remain the categories that are not only most appealing to us as investors, but I think paramount to our generation.
That's really intriguing. Give us an example of a moonshot, or what you called earlier a Mars shot, a technology or a company that can really be a game changer but may not pay off for quite a while.
We just backed a company that is focusing on food science. Oh gosh, I can't give away too much because they haven't truly launched in the U.S. But maybe I'll kind of allude to it. They use crushed produce, like crushed potato skins,
right,
to make plastic that biodegrades. And so it's a Mars shot because it's a materials business and it's a food science business rolled up into both a CPG business and an enterprise business. This particular material can wrap itself around industrial pellets. Even though it's audacious, it's not really a Mars shot when you think about the way the world is headed. Everybody wants to figure out, how do we consume less plastic and recycle plastic better? And so if there are new materials out there that will not only disintegrate, but also in some ways feed the environment, it would be a no-brainer. And then if you add to the equation the fact that it could be maybe not less expensive, but of comparable pricing to the alternative, I can't think of a company in the world that wouldn't switch to this solution.
Right. So this is plastic that you don't throw away. You just toss in the garden and it becomes compost.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Wow. It should help your garden grow. So that's what I would call a Mars shot in some ways. But in other ways, it's just common sense, right?
So let's talk a little bit about your investment vehicles. You guys run, I want to make sure I get this right, 2 funds and 3 vehicles. Is that right?
We have 2 funds. They're both considered micro funds because they're both under $100 million. And then we operate in parallel 4 SPVs that are relatively evergreen, and they serve as opportunistic investments to continue to double down on our winners.
SPVs, special purpose investment vehicles.
Yes, right. In the PE world, they're called sidecars.
That's really interesting. So how do these get structured? Does everything look very similar? When you have a fund, how quickly do you deploy the capital, and typically how long are you locked up for, or are investors locked up for?
Well, investors are usually, in private equity or VC funds, locked up for 10 years. That's not unusual. Mm-hmm. We have shown liquidity faster, certainly, for Fund 1. It's well in the black, and it's only 5 years old, less, 4.5 years old. So, how do we make money? We charge standard fees. 2 on 20 is mm-hmm. the rubric that we operate by. And then lesser fees for sidecars or direct investments. So that's kind of how we stay in business. When you think about an emerging manager starting their first fund, management fees are certainly not so we can live a lavish rock and roll life. On a $10 million fund with a 2% management fee, you're talking about $200,000 for the entire business to operate.
Wow.
So Marina and I not only, anchored our first fund with our own capital, but we didn't pay ourselves for 4 years. It's not glamorous. I mean, there's some friends of mine that think the venture capital life is glam, and it is if you're on Sand Hill Road. But if you're an EM, it's a lot more like a startup where you're burning the midnight oil, you are, bartering favors with your friends, and you are begging the smartest people you know to take a chance on you and to invite you onto their cap table. But it somehow works out because we do put in that extra effort. I think the metrics, certainly for Fund 1, have shown us that we're in this for the long haul now.
So you have Fund 1 and Fund 2. Are there mm-hmm. any plans of launching Fund 3?
Yes. I think that, given the proof points between Fund 1 and Fund 2, and a conversation that my partner and I recently had, 5 years out, are we in this? Do we love this? We do. Okay, this is our life's work. So you can see larger and more demonstrable-sized funds, but not in an outsized way, not just because we can raise more capital now, but because we want to build out a partnership and the kind of culture that we always dreamed of working for back when we were employees. So we have a very diverse set of colleagues with whom we couldn't operate, and we'll be adding to the partnership in the next 2 or 3 years, which is really exciting to say. So yes, the TMV will be around for a while.
That's really interesting. I'm going to ask you the question I ask any venture capitalist that I interview. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your best and worst investments, and what did you pass on that perhaps you wish you didn't?
Oh, gosh. The FOMO list is so long and so embarrassing. let me start with what I passed on that I regret. Well, I don't know if she really would have invited me to invest, but certainly I had a wonderful conversation with a peer from high school, Katrina Lake, when she was in beta mode for Stitch Fix. I think she was still at HBS at the time or had just recently graduated from Harvard. And Katrina and I had coffee in Minneapolis where we went to high school. And she was telling me about the Netflix for clothing that she was building. And certainly I regret not really picking up on the clues that she was offering in that conversation. Stitch Fix had an incredible IPO, and I'm a proud shareholder today. And similarly, when my friends were starting Cloudflare, which luckily they did bring me into pre-IPO, and I'm grateful for that. But when they were starting Cloudflare, I really should have jumped on that moment. Or when my buddy Ryan Graves, whom I still chat with pretty frequently, was starting out Uber in beta with Travis and Garrett. Jeez. That's another opportunity that I definitely missed. I was in Ireland when the Series A term sheet was signed. So there's such a long laundry list of name drop, missed. But in terms of what I'm proud of, I'd say far more. You know, I don't like Sophie's Choice. I don't like to cherry pick the certain investments to just brag about them. But we've talked about some on the call today. I'd rather kind of shine a light, less on my track record, right? There's a large realized IRR that I'm very proud of, but more on the opportunity of the companies that we've more recently backed. You know, Provetta, which is a CRM for oncology patients that help them navigate through the most strenuous time of their lives, and by doing so, get better access to healthcare. You know, we just wrote that check a couple of months ago, but already it's becoming a company that I couldn't be more excited about, because if they execute the way I think Shirley and Victor will, this has the power to help so many people in, you know, a profound way, not just in the Silicon Valley cliche way of this could change the world, but this could actually, you know, help people receive better care. So I'm proud of having been an early investor in, you know, the Caspers of the world. Certainly we're all getting better sleep. There's no shame there, but I'm really excited now today at investing in financial inclusion and the care economy and so on.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
And let's talk a little bit about impactful companies. Is there any difference when you're making a seed stage investment in a potentially impactful company versus traditional startup investing?
Well, pre-seed and seed investing isn't a science, and it's certainly not a science that anyone has perfected. There are people who are incredibly good at it because they have a combination of luck and access. But if you're a disciplined investor in any asset class, and I talk to my friends who run hedge funds and work for hedge funds about, you know, the 10 bets that they take a day, and I think that's a lot trickier than what I do, because our due diligence process, on average, takes an entire quarter of a year. We're not making that many investments each year. So even though it sounds sort of fruity when you look at a Y Combinator demo day, Y Com is, you know, the biggest accelerator in Silicon Valley, and they produce over 300 companies three or four times a year. Wow. When you look at the outsized valuations coming out of Y Com, it's easy to think that starting a company is as simple as sort of downloading a company in a box Excel and running with it. But from where we sit, you know, we're scorching the earth for really compelling ideas in areas that have yet to converge, and we're looking for businesses that may have never pitched a VC before. Maybe they're not even seeking capital. Maybe it's a company that, you know, isn't so interested in raising a penny of venture because they don't need to. They're profitable from day one. Those are the companies that we find most exciting, because as former operators, we know how to appeal to them, and then we also know how to work with them.
That's really interesting. Before I get to my favorite question, let me just throw you a curveball. Tell me a little bit about Business School, the podcast you hosted for quite a while.
So Synchrony Bank came to me a few years ago with a very compelling and exciting opportunity to host a podcast with them that allowed me a fortunate opportunity to travel the country. I went to just under a dozen cities to meet with founders who have persevered past their startup days. And what I loved about the concept of Business School is that the seasons that I hosted were really focused on founders who didn't have access to VC capital. They put money on credit cards or took out SBA loans or, you know, asked friends and family to give them starter capital. And then they made their business work through trying times. And when you pass the five-year mark for any business, I'm passing it right now for TMV, there's a moment of reflection where you can say, wow, I did it. You know, it's incredibly difficult to be a startup founder. More than 50% of companies fail, and probably for good reason. And so, yes, I hosted Business School season 2 and 3, and potentially there will be more seasons. And I'm very proud of the fact that at one point we cracked the top 20 business podcasts, and people seem to be really entertained through these conversations with, you know, insightful founders who were vulnerable with me about, you know, what it was like to build their business. And I like to think they were vulnerable because I have, you know, a good amount of compassion for the experience of being a founder, and also because I'm a New Yorker and I just like to talk.
You are also a founder, so there's going to be some, you know, empathy that's genuine. You went through what they're going through.
Exactly. And so, you know, what you do, Barry, is quite similar. You host an exceptionally successful business podcast, and you're also an allocator. You know that it's interesting to do both because, you know, I think that being an investor is a lot like being a journalist. You know, in both professions, you won't succeed unless you are constantly curious and if you are having conversations to listen more than you speak.
Well, I'll let you in on a little secret since it's so late in the podcast and fewer people will be hearing this. The people I invite on the show are essentially just conversations I want to have. If other people come along and listen, that's fantastic. But honestly, it's for an audience of one, namely me. The reason I wanted to have you on is because I'm intrigued by the world of venture and alternatives and impact. I think it's safe to say that a lot of people have been somewhat disappointed in the result of ESG investing and impact investing, that it's captured a lot more mindshare than it has captured capital, although we're seeing signs that's starting to shift. But then the real question becomes, all right, so I'm investing less in oil companies and more in other companies that just happen to consume fossil fuels. What's the genuine impact of my ESG investing? It feels like it's sort of de minimis, whereas what you do really feels like it has a major impact for people who are interested in having their capital make a positive difference.
Thank you for saying that. And I will return the compliment by saying that I've really enjoyed getting to know you on our wonky economist Zooms. And I think that you're right. I think that ESG investing, certainly in the public markets, has had diminished returns historically because the definition has been so bizarre and so all over the place.
Right.
And I've read incredible books from people like Anthony Buck Levine, who helped coin the term. The Rockefeller Foundation originally coined the term. You know, you read about lowercase higher R and IRIS plus measurement, and it's so hard to have just a standardization of what it means to be an impact investor. And so at TMV, we bother, but we don't bother. Rather, we kind of come up with our own subjective point of view of the world, and we say, what does impact mean to us? Certainly, it means not investing in sin stocks. But then those sin stocks have to begin somewhere. It has to begin with an idea that somebody had once upon a time. And so rather, we are investing in the way the world should look from our perspective. And with that in mind, it doesn't have to be impact like your grandpa's VC. It can be impact for a modern generation that simply thinks and behaves differently, that votes with their dollars. You know, people often say, oh, well, my ESG portfolio is underperforming. But then if you dig into the specifics, are you investing in Tesla? Had a pretty good year. Did you back Beyond Meat? Had a great year. And so when you kind of redefine the public market, not by a sleeve in, you know, a bank's version of a portfolio, but rather by companies that you think are making demonstrable change in the world, then you can walk away realizing, oh, had I only invested in these companies that are purpose-driven, I would have had outsized returns. And that's what we're trying to deliver on at TMV. That's the promise.
Hmm. really, really very, very intriguing. I know I only have you for a few minutes, so let's jump to my favorite questions that I ask all of our guests. Starting with, tell us what you're streaming these days. Give us your favorite Netflix, Amazon Prime, or any podcasts that are keeping you entertained during the pandemic.
Well, my family has been binging on 100 Foot Wave on HBO Max, which is the story of big wave surfer Garrett McNamara, who is constantly surfing the world's largest waves. And I'm fascinated by people who have a mission that's sort of bigger than success or fame, but they're driven by something, and part of that something is curiosity, and part of it is insanity. And so not only is it visually stunning to kind of watch these big wave surfers in Portugal, but it's also a mind trip. You know, what motivates them to get out of bed every day and potentially risk their lives doing something so dangerous and so bananas, but also at the same time so brave and heroic. So highly recommend. Listening to too many podcasts. I listen to, I don't know, a stream of things from, I'm a big, you know, Kara Swisher fan, Ezra Klein fan. So they're both part of the New York Times these days. And of course, your podcast, Barry.
Well, thank you so much. Let's talk a little bit about who your early mentors were and who helped shape your career.
It's going to sound ungrateful, but I don't think in like a post-Lean-In definition of the word, I've ever truly had a mentor or a sponsor. Now, having said that, I've had people who've really looked out for me and been incredibly gracious with their time and capital, and so I would absolutely like to acknowledge that first and foremost. You know, I think about how generous Adam Grant has been with his time and his investments for TMV in Fund 1 and Fund 2, and he's the best-selling author and Wharton's highest-rated business school professor. So shout out to Adam if he's listening, or Beth Comstock, the former vice chair of GE, who has been instrumental in my career for about a decade and a half now. And she's also, you know, really leaning into the TMV portfolio and has become a patient of Parsley Health, an early investment of ours, and also an official advisor to the business. So people like Adam and Beth certainly come to mind. But I don't know. I'm not sure mentors really exist outside of corporate America anymore. And part of the reason why we started Transact Global is to kind of foster the concept of the peer mentor, people who are going through the same thing as you at the same time, and allowing that hive mentality with an abundance mentality to catalyze people to kind of go further and faster.
Let's talk about some of your favorite books and what you might be reading right now.
Okay, so in the biz book world, because I know what your listeners are craving, I'm a big fan of Negotiation Genius. I took a crash course with one of the authors, Max Bazerman, at the Kennedy School, and it was illuminating. I mean, he's one of the most captivating professors I've ever had the pleasure of hearing lecture. And this book has really helped me understand the concept of the ZOPA, the Zone of Possible Agreement, and how to really negotiate well. And then for Adam, whom I just referenced, of all of his incredible books, my favorite is Give and Take, because I try to operate with that approach in business. You know, give more than you take, and maybe in the short term you'll feel depleted, but in the long term, you know, karma pays off. But mostly, Barry, I read fiction. I think the most interesting people in the world, or at least the most entertaining at dinner parties, are all avid readers of fiction and history. So I recently reread, for instance, all of my favorite short stories from college, from Dostoevsky's A Gentle Creature to Drown by Juan O'Diaz, Passing by Nella Larsen, The Diamond as Big as the Ritz by Fitzgerald. Those are some of my very favorite stories of all time, and my retirement dream is to write a book of short stories.
Really, really quite intriguing. Are they all available in a single collection, or are these just going back to your favorites and just plowing through them for fun?
Those are just going back to my favorites. I try to reread Passing every few years. It just somehow seems to be more and more relevant as I get older. Juan O'Diaz has become so incredibly famous since I first read Drown about 20 years ago. But it's his original collection of short stories that, you know, broadened my perspective of why it's important to think about a broader definition of America, I guess. Mm-hmm. And yeah, no, that's just that was just sort of off the top of my head, is a pilfering of a few stories that I really love.
That's a good collection. And we're down to our final two questions. What sort of advice would you give to a recent college grad who is interested in a career in either venture capital or entrepreneurship?
Venture capital or entrepreneurship? Well, I would say learn as early as possible how to trust your gut. So this could mean a myriad of things. As an entrepreneur, it could mean under the halo effect of an institution, university or high school, or maybe having a comfortable day job, tinker with ideas, get feedback on that idea. Don't be afraid of looking or sounding dumb, and build that peer network that I described, people who are rooting you on, and are also insatiably curious about wonky things. And I would say that for venture capital, similar play on the same theme, but you know, whether it's putting small amounts of money into, you know, new concepts, blockchain investing, or whether it's meeting with entrepreneurs and saying, maybe I only have $3,000 saved up, but I believe in you enough to bet a month's rent in Brooklyn on your concept if you'll have me as an investor. So play with your own money, because what it's really teaching you in return is how to follow instincts and to base pattern recognition off of your own judgment. And if you do that early on, over time, these all become data points that you can point to, and these are lessons that you can glean while not taking the risk of portfolio management. So I guess the real advice to your listeners is, you know, more action, please.
Really very, very intriguing. And our final question, what do you know about the world of venture investing today that you wish you knew 15 or 20 years ago when you were first getting started?
20 years ago, I was a bit of a Pollyanna, and I thought every wonderful idea that simply is built by smart people and has timed the market correctly will work out. And I will say that I'm slightly more jaded today because of the capital structure that is systematically allowing the biggest firms in the world to kind of eat up a generous portion of, let's call it the LP pie, which leaves less capital available to the young upstart VC firms, and of course I'm biased because I run one, that are taking outsized risk on those non-obvious ideas that we referenced. And so what I wish for the future is that institutional capital kind of reprioritizes what it's looking for. And in addition to having a bottom line of reliable and, you know, demonstrable return on any given investment, there are new standards put into place saying we want to make sure that a portion of our portfolio goes to diverse managers, because in turn we recognize that they are three times more likely to invest in diverse founders. Or we believe that impact investing can be broader than the ESG definition of a decade ago. So we're coming up with our own way to measure what sustainability or what impact means to us. And if they go through those exercises, which I know is hard, because certainly I'm not trying to add work to anyone's plate, I do think that the results will more than make up for it.
Quite intriguing. Thank you, Soraya, for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with Soraya Dorabi, who is the co-founder and general partner at TMV Investments. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and check out any of the prior 376 conversations we've had before. You can find those at iTunes or Spotify or wherever you buy your favorite podcasts. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. You can sign up for my daily reads at ritholtz.com. Check out my weekly column at bloomberg.com/opinion. Follow me on Twitter at ritholtz. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack team that helps me put these conversations together each week. Tim Harrow is my audio engineer. Paris Wold is my producer. Atika Valbrun is our project manager. Michael Batnick is my head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.